Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplexes and at the art house.
Warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or doghouse in that area.
You'll also hear about new and old films on Blu-ray and on DVD. Plus, you'll hear all the latest Hollywood gossip.
I don't care!
Okay, maybe not the latter, but it is time for Film Sociology with WFYI's film guru.
Kaiser Schizzi!
No, that's Matthew Sosie.
It's such a fine line between stupid and clever. Yes.
Let's see how thin the line is. Here's your host, Matthew Sosie.
Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Sosie. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for those who listened in on the special two-part edition of Film Sociology. The last 2 weeks, my epic chat with No Limits host John Krull, breaking down more about Elvis Presley movies than anybody's ever asked for, ever. But it was fun doing it. So back in the saddle, back reviewing movies, and joining me is, well, we have a lot to cover, and we are able to do it with vim and vigor, the Film Yap's Chris Lloyd. Or as we like to refer to him around here, the Chris Lloyd. Because we're talking about the other Chris Lloyd later. Hi, Chris.
How's it going? No, I have to fess up. In fact, you know, he's Chris Lloyd. I'm the other one.
Well, not in our hearts. So there. Good to have you here, man.
Oh, great to always be here.
So it's July. We're past July 4th. Will Smith does not have a film opening. That used to be a thing for a while, ladies and gentlemen. But I guess, first off, I guess I'm delaying a little bit. So your take on the films of Elvis Presley, since John and I devoted two shows to this idea.
My take is I have seen embarrassingly few of them. Viva Las Vegas, and I'm trying to think of King Creole.
Yeah, yes.
And then maybe one other. I think that's about it. I really have not seen it. Because the thing is, his films are not, what's the kind way? His films are not as well known today as they were back in the day. I think you have to be kind of a certain generation even to be aware of how many movies he did make during his career.
You mean John and I?
Yes.
Well, I would say I have to say from Love Me Tender to Viva Las Vegas might be a good place to start. This is a nice sly way of doing the Chris. You know what you should do for your column? It's the film critic equivalent of, you know what you should watch? You know what you should do for your show? So anyway, that's worth checking out. And we're going to get to Reeling Back from the Film Yap, one of my favorite segments in a little bit. There are certain people that, and Chris is one of them, that all I have to do is write or just say Friday, and then I can find out if he can or if he cannot. So
yeah.
Anyway, we're back at July 4th. So I guess we'll start with something that was not, I don't think it was screened for the press. And honestly, I have not seen any of them, and I'm really okay. But did you see the first Purge?
No, they actually did screen that for us, but it was on the same night as Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Oh, well, that's...
So I assigned that to one of our junior film yappers, Andrew Carr, who's got a beautiful review up, so you can go check that out. He actually said it was...
A beautiful review?
It's a beautiful review. It's just beautiful. But he said it was actually much better than he expected, and, if you're into those, which... I was having this debate with someone earlier. It's like, are those horror films? I don't know if I would really call those The Purge horror.
Documentaries.
Yeah. Let's see. Well, that's next year.
Next year
there'll be documentaries.
Right. Okay, but the big title opening this week is Ant-Man and the Wasp. We have a second Ant-Man film from the Marvel comic universe. And I think I'm safe to say, the lightest of the Marvel films.
Yeah, these are popcorn movies. I don't think they're intended as anything other than popcorn movies. I actually like that in the fact that, you know, I like the superhero movies. People ask me all the time, well, when is the superhero movie fad going to fade? And it's like, well, when the movies start to get really bad.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a few clunkers, you know, Green Lantern and things like that. But you know, particularly with the Marvel films, I mean, to me, they're maintaining a really high standard of excellence for the most part. I mean, Avengers Infinity War has kind of typified, though, where the genre is at, which is like it's very dark, it's very dramatic, it's very end-of-the-worldy. I mean, every movie is about the end of the world, it seems like. And it's nice to acknowledge that in fact, you know, superheroes, you know, aren't going to be saving the world every single day. That probably, you know, for 1,000 days in a row, they're just trying to nab, like, you know, the jewel thief or, you know, the gang that's trying to put the squeeze on the Italian restaurant. So here's that movie. You know, here's the movie with Ant-Man and the Wasp. Their powers is that they wear these suits that make them shrink. And when they get small, they somehow get stronger. I forget how that worked. Paul Rudd and Evangeline Lilly, respectively, as Ant-Man and the Wasp. And he can also command insects. So those are their powers. They get small. They get kind of strong. I mean, not like, you know, Hulk strong, but they get kind of strong.
For mass, I guess, you know, for somebody that's teeny, teeny, tiny, it kind of packs a wall up.
Yeah, and you can tell ants where to go and what to do. So it's kind of cool, but, you know, then they have a lot of fun with, like, shrinking and enlarging stuff.
They do that quite a bit in this one.
Yeah.
And that is fun.
It's like they're being chased by bad guys, so all they have is, like, a Pez dispenser. So they enlarge the Pez dispenser, you know, so that it's, like, you know, the size of a steel girder from a skyscraper. And that's the movie. And there's no end of the world. There's no we're all going to die. It's literally just they have their own intersecting goals that they want to do, which are, for some people, benevolent. For other people, a little less benevolent. Theirs is they want to rescue somebody's mom. The Evangeline Lilly character, Michael Douglas, is the father. And so they're going to, you know, find her back in the subatomic zone that she got shrunk down into 30 years ago.
I think the drinking game for this is subatomic.
Yeah.
And she's played, mom's played by Michelle Pfeiffer, who, not really giving away a whole lot, she has she's now at a part in her career where she can play characters with white hair, and she's still stunning. And I want her to star in the Emmylou Harris Story. Because we know she can sing. But anyway, I'm not sure that's going to happen.
So, yeah, it's a popcorn movie, and gosh, what do you know? It's the middle of popcorn season. There's nothing wrong with popcorn movies.
And don't let this throw you off, but normally when I see something with five credited screenwriters with an ampersand, which means they're all working together, I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
And I will say there is a lot of story going on, despite it being one of the lighter ones, because you have the Paul Rudd character who's almost done with house arrest. So, and I'm like, okay, one of the writers took care of that. And then the main plot, as you described, Lawrence Fishburne is now thrown into the fray, and he is the mentor for a young lady, I believe it was the Phantom.
The Ghost.
The Ghost, sorry. She, Billy Zane. Didn't mean to offend you there.
I also like the fact that there are superpowered people who don't give themselves names. Other people just call them something like The Ghost.
Right. And so that's kind of, for lack of a better term, there is the kind of, it's kind of like Josh Brolin in Deadpool too. It's not the bad guy, but maybe the adversary, but you have to have some form of foil.
They're adjacent to badness.
There
Let's put
you
it
go.
That way.
Yeah, and it's the case of Ghost who can not only get in and out of matter. So
she can phase in and out.
Fades in and out. So those fight sequences are kind of fun. So you have the action stuff as far as size and matter, and then you have a fight, you know, somebody you can throw a punch, but you cannot hit.
Right.
So that story is going on, and then you have to throw some comedy in there. Always good to have Michael Pena get to do his one saxophone solo in the group. It's fun to watch Michael Pena do drama or do comedy.
Yeah.
And I think he has become, if he's not, you know, I don't know if we haven't checked the rankings lately. I think he's an underrated actor, and partly because he does the job.
Yeah.
I mean, no matter if it's drama or comedy, he's always likable.
He never looks down the material.
No, he does not. So, and, you know, part of what made the first Ant-Man so much fun is this kind of lighthearted comic relief, and he provides that in this one as well. Oh yeah, I guess you also have Walton Goggins. He's probably the nastiest of the people in this.
Plays like a black market tech dealer who wants the shrinking tech for himself, and
yeah. So that's probably, he's probably, I would say, in the on the Level of badness, he's probably at the bottom, but it's not very deep.
Yeah, I do like the MO. You know, so Henry Pym, played by Michael Douglas, is the guy who invented all this technology and kind of is very, you know, prickly and guards it ferociously.
He's got to be.
He and the Lawrence Fishburne character are kind of like old rivals.
They don't like each other.
But like, you know, so they're on the land themselves now. And so I love the thing that since they can shrink and enlarge things, so what they do is they have their laboratory, which is like a, you know, like an 8-foot story or an 8-story building. It's like a, you know, like a small skyscraper. And so when they just set up somewhere like an empty lot, and then when they're done, they just shrink it down and off they go.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And then and the it's about the about the size of traveling luggage, and they do that very smart.
They literally have built a telescoping handle into the top of the building so that when it's small, they can just pick it up. Although I did ask about what's the power source for the building since it's completely mobile. Oh, my favorite thing is so he carries around with him the little like circular Hot Wheels case that like little boys would store their Hot Wheels in. And so they have like, you know, 24 Hot Wheels cars, except that they're actual real vehicles that they've shrunk down. So it's like, okay, well, we need the van. They pull out like the utility van and make it large again. And now they've got a utility van, or they need a fast car. They pull one of those out. And isn't that every little boy's fantasy to make your Hot Wheels get big and drivable?
It kind of is. So this is also directed by Peyton Reed, who did the last film. And so, as far as – and I had my daughter with me. She's 16. So I've learned a couple things. One, Paul Rudd is now in her Patrick Dempsey world of hunky older gentlemen. My daughter likes older actors. But she, you know, it makes sense because she's used to – Clueless era Paul Rudd and Friends era Paul Rudd. And I think the last thing she saw Paul Rudd do was Anchorman 2, and that was kind of forgettable. So, so I've learned that. But she's always been hesitant about the Marvel Universe because it's all connected. Like, I know she's not going to see Avengers, but this is her sixth solo picture. So it's fun to get a good beam on her because she's seen both Deadpools, the first Guardians, Doctor Strange, because she likes Benedict Cumberbatch, Black Panther, and this. So when asked, you know, does this – how much of the overall, the Marvel – especially the film that came out earlier this year, how much of it has anything to do with Ant-Man and the Wasp? Almost none. There is the final – there's two nuggets in the closing credits for you nerds out there. The second one has something in – automatically connecting to the last Avengers film. I'm going to be vague as possible. And I was very grumpy. I was a grumpy old critic about the end of the Avengers because my thoughts were, you're not going to let all that money get off the table. I'm sorry. And so the fact that there were people my age gasping at that final little nugget, and I'm just sitting there on the front porch going, no, they're not going to let this money go off the table. So that's a personal film critic quibble, and it will not take away from your enjoyment of the film.
Yeah.
So, okay. So that is out there. Now, if you want something smaller, there is a film that's out now at the at your local art house complex called Boundaries. And Vera Farmiga, who is always a fan, she's a film sociology fan of her work, and Christopher Plummer, and we also have cameos by Bobby Cannavale, who actually has more lines to say in this film than he does in Ant-Man, Peter Fonda, and the other Chris Lloyd is in this. And this is the film, ladies and gentlemen, where when you have decades of family drama and bitterness, all you need to erase all of that is one simple car ride.
Yes.
And that's kind of what this film is.
And why not be in a vintage Rolls Royce?
I immediately thought of you because Chris Lloyd is also the cinematic car correspondent here at Film Sociology.
Yes. Yes. By the way, little tip. One of my favorite websites is the Internet Movie Vehicle Database, which,
create that?
No, I wish I had, though. But, literally, you can, like, oh, what was that car? I'm probably right now, but in a couple of months when they've updated it, you probably go find what year Rolls Royce was that in Boundaries.
Wow.
Yeah.
So Farmiga is the mom. She's a divorced mom. Kid has some school troubles, and she wants to get him into a really good school, but for special needs.
Troubled artists.
There you go. Troubled artists. But, you know, life is not going well with her, as you would think. And then she finally gets a call from her estranged father, played by Christopher Plummer. He is also getting kicked out of his old age retirement home because he's a pot dealer.
Yes.
So she's got to pick dad up and then bring him to California, hopefully to stay with her sister, played by Kristen Schaal. I want to see the mom now.
Yeah.
When the siblings are Vera and Kristen and your father is Christopher Plummer, I want to know who the mom was.
Yes.
But, and of course they're going to make a trip from, it looks like from Washington State all the way down to California.
It's Seattle to Los Angeles.
Okay.
Which, of course, I in the old days I would have said we MapQuested it, but with Google directions, which is a 17-hour drive, but in movies it takes a week.
Three cinema, yeah, yeah. Yeah, there are trips along the way, and of course, Christopher Plummer, being the rascallion of the group, has filled the trunk, which apparently nobody else opens.
Yes.
But there is also a recurring bit with Christopher Plummer and Depends. And there's really other things in the Depends.
That's the undergarment, not the equivocation.
No, correct. So, okay. So this is the type of film that we've seen the road trip film. We've seen the family road trip film. I think it probably reached its peak with Little Miss Sunshine, but they still make them.
Yeah.
And this is a film where, well, the performance, even if the script is completely by the numbers, which this is, usually the performances will elevate that. And Vera's good, and Chris is good, Christopher Plummer, and you know, the cameos are amusing, but it really doesn't elevate a whole lot.
Yeah, I call it the road picture. They got the screener to me very late, so I finished it at midnight, and I literally wrote my review while I was waiting to go on air. At my local TV station.
Say it, Indie Style. Yeah, you can look at him on Indie Style.
We're allowed to mention, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I had Tracy Forner on here a few weeks ago.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's the road trip movie that doesn't really go anywhere. You know, we've got all these great actors. We've got lots and lots of encounters. There's lots of dialogue, but not really a whole lot of sharing, substantive information.
Mm-hmm.
They sort of are chewing over the same issues again and again and not really resolving it until it's the point in the movie where it's time to resolve it. And the kid, you know, I didn't think they did enough with the kid. He's just supposed to be just... cut off and ostracized. His big problem that he keeps getting in trouble in school is that he keeps drawing nude portraits of the authority figures
while they're sleeping too. That's
yeah, or in repose, a different kind of repose, we shall say. Definitely very sexual in nature, these, and not flattering in these portraits, particularly to the male folk. I kept waiting for them to do more with that. There's the sort of the side trip to go see the estranged dad, Bobby Cavanaugh character, which that whole thing just felt very rote. I don't know. I have to admit, I was a little bit bewildered and kind of a bit bored by this film. It's unfortunate with such a great cast.
Yeah, it's so, but it's out there. So if you know that is. And by the way, they actually went there, but when the sisters show up, and I remember disliking it even as far back as the film Stepmom, but I don't need grown people lip syncing to old hits, even in this case Laura Branigan's Gloria.
Yeah,
but because it's an independent film and it's cheaper, I will say this: that there's a couple things that another thing that I'm not crazy about with particular road pictures, or in this case, is there's going to be a sense of danger, or the police will get involved, and as happens in two cases, there's one sequence at Peter Fonda's house, and there is a run-in with the police. Those are handled lighter than I had anticipated.
Yeah.
I think a studio picture would have taken those curveballs, and the film would have gone down a completely different path. So.
Yeah.
For an independent standpoint, from an indie film standpoint that, you know, doesn't really elevate it, at least it doesn't – it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
So congratulations. Okay. That's really about it for this week as far as –
The documentary Whitney, based on Whitney Houston, is
coming
out.
Oh, yes. They
did not screen it for us, unfortunately.
That's unfortunate.
I hear it's fairly tough. It, you know, sort of looks at the warts and all. Which, I mean, people forget, you know, 25 years ago, how beloved, you know, America loved Whitney Houston.
Right.
Like
and, you
few
know,
others.
Many would say her Star Spangled Banner is the one.
Yeah.
I'm kind of partial to Marvin Gaye myself.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was that, and you know, do you blame Bobby? Do you blame the family? Do you blame the one, you know, the behind the scenes stuff? But yeah. Yeah, there she was in the by the end of the 80s, I mean, untouchable.
Yeah.
And fortunately it happened. So that is out there as well. Looking at the DVD and Blu-ray titles, Beirut?
Blockers?
Yeah.
Kind of a slow week for that.
And oh, 7 days in Entebbe. So if you need a Rosamund Pike fix, there's two of them right
there.
That one wasn't
bad. Was it
Daniel Stroll?
Yeah, I think he was in it.
Did you see that?
Yeah.
Did you like it?
Yeah, it was pretty decent. Okay. It's a look at the, was it 1979 terrorist hijacking of an airplane?
I believe so, yeah.
With Israelis making up about half of the passengers, I think. Yeah, sort of a tense historical drama.
There you go. So anyway, that is out there as well. Okay, to visit the drive-ins. We love going to the drive-ins. Okay, at the Tibbs, screen one. Ant-Man and the Wasp, and The Incredibles 2. That makes perfect sense.
It does.
By the way, you enjoyed Incredibles 2?
I did. Not as much as the first one, but it was a good reprise. Yeah.
And I think, you know, when old critics grumble like me about sequels are not necessary, I'm like, okay, this one's pretty good. So that's out there. Ooh, Screen 2, Uncle Drew and Superfly.
I liked Uncle Drew.
You did more than I thought.
I was surprised. I mean, that's a classic example of what our good friend and fellow film critic Ed Johnson Ott of Nouveau Newsweekly would say. I just like spending time with these characters.
And you did with these guys.
Yeah, you know, it's literally, you know, they could take anything and make it into a movie. So this is, we're taking a TV, those TV commercials you see where they get a pro ball player, in this case basketball players, dress them up as an old man makeup. And then he, you know, goes and challenges some young bucks and proceeds to school them. Okay, here's an hour and 45 minutes of that.
Are you angry that they didn't make a Little Penny movie 20 years ago? I'll take that as a no. So,
but,
all right.
It's got Shaquille O'Neal in it making fun of his own previous film roles. So that's a lot of fun.
He gets a free throw, doesn't he?
And Kyrie Irving using the term young blood about 875,000 times.
Drinking game. All right, is this Shaq's best performance?
Sure. He doesn't actually say very much. His character is called Big Fella. Like, literally, that's the name of his character, is Big Fella. And the idea is that they're all supposed to be, like, 75 years old, and they're now coming back to hoop it.
Is this, like, for the boys' makeup bad?
It's weird. So, like, they have Shaquille, of course, Indiana's own Reggie Miller in it, plays the blind sharpshooter. And I hate to say it, I'm not trying to be mean, but... they really don't look that different from how they look today. Because, I mean, if you do the math, those guys now are closer in age to the old guy characters than to the young buck characters.
Kind of like the Rolling Stones are now the age of Muddy and Wolf and those guys. But what you're saying, it sounds like you're saying, is Rick Baker didn't work on this.
Yeah, but some of them, Kyrie Irving is the main character, is good. Actually, the one that's the best is Nate Robinson, plays Boots, the old point guard. And he looks so good that I actually thought they had said, okay, well, we're actually going to get like some 1970s NBA star and going to put him in the movie, because he looked really convincing.
Okay, now Earl the Pearl's angry.
See, that's what I thought, like, you know, Earl the Pearl Monroe or somebody like that what was the guy from the Knicks championship?
Bernard King.
Yeah, one of those guys, something like that.
Okay, so yeah, have you seen The Fish That Saves Pittsburgh?
No.
Or Fast Break?
No.
Well, there's two more to add to your never-ending list of, and those are 70s basketball movies. Yeah. There. All right, so Uncle Drew and Superfly. Yes, I saw Superfly. And my curiosity got the worst of me. While the Ron O'Neill Superfly is a great soul album put on film, this is a auto-tuned rap album film, and that's, I will say, the lead is good. He's fine, and it follows the storyline for the most part, and there's a couple of a couple of Curtis Mayfield tracks, but that's really about it. Screen 3, Jurassic World and The First Purge. And then, here we go. I think cuz they're both R-rated. Screen 4, Sicario and Tag.
Yeah. those are both pretty underwhelming movies.
No, but did you see the second Sicario?
Yeah.
Same writer. The stunning.
Taylor Sheridan.
Taylor Sheridan, I'm stunned.
He's done Hell or High Water. He also did the one with Jeremy Renner. The name is escaping right now.
White River? No. It'll come to me.
That I also really, really liked a lot. Wasn't quite the masterpiece of Hell or High Water, but it was still quite good. So he wrote the first one. Wind River. I was not crazy about the first Sicario, so here's the sequel, which he's now also directing. I believe he's also directed this. No, I may be wrong about
you
that.
But
he did do the screenplay.
I guess they wanted to make a Peckinpah film without Sam Peckinpah. So.
Yeah, so this one is more or less a straight action thriller, to my mind.
I think the whole point, and I like the first Sicario, Denise, the gentleman who gave us Arrival and Prisoners and your top film of last year, did the first one. And
Denise Villeneuve.
Thank you. Pardon your French.
I think that's
we'll be butchering more French later on in the show. We'll get to that. But but the whole point was the Emily Blunt character, who's not in this one. We see her go from kind of vim and vigor and, ready to, get the bad guys. And she sinks deeper and deeper into red tape and corruption and just finds out her job is completely worthless by the end of the film. And that's the whole point. And now we have a second film, which I will say I've not seen, but it just, like you said, it looks more like a straight-ahead action film, which is why I'm stunned that Taylor Sheridan actually wrote this one as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a bad movie. It sort of does its thing, well enough. It's just, the first one was much more of a psychological movie, and this one is not.
I'm wondering if there will be a straight-to-video Sicario 3. It'll suffer from Jarhead's disease.
Yeah, it's weird because I looked it up. The first one did not do, amazingly well theatrically. I mean, it wasn't a bomb, but it was sort of a middling reception from the box office. So my understanding is that they actually committed to doing a sequel even before the first one was released. So somebody liked it.
It's a signing bonus. So anyway, that is at the Tibbs over at the Skyline in Shelbyville. Jurassic World and Tag. Sure. They want the kids to fall asleep by the second feature, I guess.
Yep.
So, okay. Moving on a little bit. I do want to, I do have one video I want to talk about. I got this recently, and I'm trying to catch up because I'm behind. I had the Elvis stuff. But I was really excited that Film Movement Classics, this is the Classics branch of the Film Movement website. I like to call it their Film of the Month Club. Every month you get a thing. But this is the 50th anniversary restoration of a Sergio Carbucci Western, which I had not seen, called The Great Silence. And for those who, Sergio Carbucci is the gentleman who gave us the original Django, the one with Franco Nero, and later did, I think a year or so after Django, did a film which I unabashedly own, and I don't know if I love it, but it's just hysterical, called Navajo Joe, which starred Burt Reynolds. And Burt Reynolds is a Native American who's left for dead, and he's going to get everybody back in all sorts of elaborate ways. And what I've liked about Carbucci was kind of the anti-Leone for a couple reasons. His films were bloodier, they were more bleak, and we'll get to that in a little bit. And the first Django film with Franco Nero, he originally wanted to shoot it in snow, and the studio said that was too expensive, so he did it in a Western town that was just caked in mud. Mm. And we had not seen it. We're used to dust and tumbleweeds and that sort of thing. Well, he gets to shoot it in snow in The Great Silence. This was shot in northern Italy, where especially near the mountains it can get very snowy, and of course if it got too wet or too warm, you just put in pumped in shaving cream. I mean, that it's not quite Running Scared bad. If you've ever seen the 80s film Running Scared with Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines, they're Chicago cops, and it's supposed to be in the winter, and you can see shaving cream falling off trees. So anyway, but this is a story of a group of bounty hunters who have various degrees of ethics.
Yes.
And our hero in this is a mute gunfighter, and I'm going to butcher, we're butchering French here at Film Sociology, Jean-Louis Trintignant, who, looking through, if you are a foreign film fan, appeared in the 60s in films like Is Paris Burning? This film, of course, he was in Z. He was in The Conformist, The Crook. So one of those, The Last Train from 1973. Most recently played one of the older gentlemen, not the husband, in Amour. Mm. And he was in, he played George Laurent in Happy End, the latest Paul Verhoeven picture. Anyway, so on one side we have a mute gunfighter, and then we find out how he became mute and what it's a similar Charles Bronson in Once Upon a Time in the West vibe to it. On the other end, you have Klaus Kinski, who whoever dubbed him gave him kind of a Peter Lorre vocal vibe about him. But he is your bad bounty hunter. Vonette McKee is also in this for you fans of Blackula. She plays she was the woman who was with William Marshall's character, and she's in this as well. So we have, like I said, various degrees of bounty hunters. We also have a film, this is 1968, where you get an aftermath of blood. It's not Peckinpah, but, you know, you get a shot, for instance, if, you know, somebody will turn and there'll be blood on their forehead.
Yeah.
This was a big deal in 1968. The other thing that this film has going for it and caught me off guard, and sorry, spoiler alert on a 50-year-old film, but the bad guys win in this.
Yeah.
And we get to the final shootout between the two leads, the ones that are on the poster, and we get to the shootout, and not only does the bad guy win, but then he has about two dozen hostages, all of which are gunned down brutally. And the film ends with music by Ennio Morricone, of course. So anyway, it's a really good print. It's understated performances, especially from Kinski. I think we're used to watching him be a raving lunatic for Werner Herzog.
True scenery, yeah.
Right, but that's not the case in this. So so yeah, not a bad Western from Sergio Carbucci. And I think he I know cinephiles like Tarantino and others hold him in high regard. But this is a really good print. It looks really good. And now it's available on video or on Blu-ray from Film Movement Classics.
Cool.
So check that out. All right. We have a couple of dead people we like, because we never have time for dead people we don't like. And the gentleman, where is it? Oh, yeah, Claude Lanzmann. If anything else, did the documentary Shoah.
Yeah.
It was a 9-hour documentary about the Holocaust.
Mm.
He had passed away at the age of 92. And this was a film I remember Siskel and Ebert championing from the get-go. And it's been kind of hailed as the definitive documentary about this subject. It's also long as hell. So it's, you know, this is not a walk in the park as far as sitting down and enjoying for a couple of hours. This thing goes on, and rightly so. So that is out there. Also, cinematographer Robbie Muller, he's a Dutch gentleman,
mm-hmm.
who worked tirelessly, worked throughout the late 60s and early 70s, of course, in his native land, and then made the transition into Hollywood. One of his first films, these titles you'll probably know, and I would even add, Chris, these are titles you should have on your show. But I think his first American film was he did work on The American Friend with Wim Wenders, worked with Peter Bogdanovich on Saint Jack, as well as They All Laughed, the one with Dorothy Stratton. He also did the cinematography for Honeysuckle Rose.
Yeah.
Where there was that brief period where Willie Nelson was a bankable film star, would later do Repo Man, Paris, Texas, Body Rock, was director of photography on To Live and Die in L.A., was director of photography on Down by Law, Barfly, The Believers, a segment of Coffee and Cigarettes, Until the End of the World, Mad Dog and Glory, Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man from 1995, Breaking the Waves, working with Lars von Trier in 1996, The Tango Lesson, Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai, and his last noted couple pictures were 24-Hour Party People and a segment, I believe it's the Cate Blanchett segment of Coffee and Cigarettes. Mm. So all fascinating titles that we're checking out, all done by Robbie. All right, ladies and gentlemen, as I said, Chris Lloyd is hanging out with me here. And Chris has a segment called Reeling Back. It is, as I've said before, one of my favorites. And every film critic has their flags that they plant. And they don't care what anybody says. And in fact, I always say every year there's always one film that one critic in our group will like or not like, and everybody else will make fun of them for it.
Yeah.
For instance, I love the musical Nine. Y'all can kiss my whatever. So stuff like that. I believe you held Julie and Julia at a higher esteem than
Yeah, that was
most
my favorite film of that year. Actually, that film caused the Indiana Film Journal Association to alter the way we vote on our awards.
Way to go.
Yeah.
So. I would say this year, of course, Evan Dossie is Mr. Paddington 2.
Yes, I'm not sure how serious he is about that. Apparently, at least
he's very serious. I've had him on because I remember saying I told him, I said after a couple of weeks I thought it was a bit, but no, he's kind of serious about
that. Shtick. Oh,
okay, so now that's just for a single film, but we all have our quote unquote guilty pleasures, or as Nigella Lawson once said, if you feel pleasure, why feel guilty? I love blaxploitation. Bob Blum, of course, loves any of the Hammer and Roger Corman stuff of the 60s. But Chris Lloyd, I did not realize how much you enjoyed Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things.
Yes.
State your case.
Well, this is a film that, you know, anybody who knows me has probably heard me reference, probably just like with Evan on Paddington. You know, they probably took it as joking. When I said that Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things from 1972 was one of my favorite all-time films. Because it is a piece of extremely low-quality, low-budget trash. And I say that gleefully. And you and I were talking earlier about the distinction between trash movies versus garbage movies. Trashy movies can be a lot of fun because they sort of revel in their own, you know, low budget and silliness and, you know, preciousness. Garbage movies are movies that are terrible and don't know they're terrible. The great critic for The New Yorker, Pauline Kael, you know, had made the distinction. She referred to what she called glorious trash and then what I call garbage movies. So I would definitely put Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things at the top of my glorious trash list. This was the first feature film directed by Bob Clark, which I know that name is probably not a whole household name just because
Bob Clark has some fascinating footnotes in cinema history, especially North American cinema history.
He is one of the, I believe he's Canadian.
He is Canadian.
He is one of the most eclectic filmographies of anybody that worked, you know, in mainstream Hollywood films. So he made that film where they shot it for $50,000 in 2 weeks. It's set in an island off of Miami. I'm not sure if it was actually shot in Miami or not. Most of the people in it were like his friends, and most of the actors, like their real name, they just used that as the name of their character.
They have the Tony Danza syndrome. They can't answer to a fake name.
Right. The kind of the ostensible main character is this leader of a theatrical troupe. That guy also, I'm forgetting his name now, but it's in the column. He also co-wrote the movie and did most of the makeup effects for the zombies. The setup is it's a bunch of young people in a theatrical troupe who go to an island to raise the dead in a, bonding ceremony, I guess. But it's all a ruse to play a trick, but of course things end up going badly, and they actually do raise the dead and all get messily eaten.
Thus the title. So
yes.
I remember renting this on Betamax. It was that long ago. So I'm going to guess I was not at the right age to check this out. Probably what I remember, and you will have heard, I remember there's a lot of what seemed like a lot of quasi-hippie babble.
Yeah, there is.
And then the last 10-15 minutes really kind of packs a punch, but I think I was slightly bored by the time we got to that. Is that a fair assessment?
That is fairly true. It's about like an 85-minute movie, and I don't think the first zombie, like animated zombie, shows up until after the 1 hour mark.
Okay, so I'm not completely crazy.
And the makeup is pretty hokey. And the guy who plays like the boss zombie, that was his first and only movie he was ever in. And it's just such a wonderfully, gleefully shticky movie. I just love everything about it. You know, but here's the thing: as much as I joke about it, and because I had made jokes about the what people took as jokes about my love for it all the years, I finally decided to go ahead and do the deep dive right. and actually write the in-depth column about it, the movie, and why I think it works so well and why it does so many things. It really is, in its own way, kind of an important film in that people have this conception that George Romero made Night of the Living Dead, and then boom, the horror genre and the zombie movie subgenre took off. And that, you know,
not true.
If you actually look at it, this was pretty much the next mainstream Hollywood, even, you know, low budget zombie movie after, you know, the 4 years since Return of the Living Dead or Night of the Living Dead. And then only after that, 73, 74, did other films start coming out. Italians had made a couple of things.
Right.
But really, it really the zombie movie genre, and I would argue the greater horror genre, really took off around this time. And also, this film is funny. It's intended to be funny. It has lots of humorous moments. And that really was a new thing. I mean, where intent, you know, nowadays with the modern concept of horror is, with rare exception, we pretty much, you know, comedy is baked into the pie.
Right.
Of the modern horror genre.
I will personally blame Freddy Krueger for that. I mean, it really made a turn after that.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of had the slasher films in the late 70s and early days, you know, Halloween, Friday the 13th. But even that, there was a little bit of sly humor in that.
A little bit.
But, I mean, I think really with this film, and then you got into, like, you know, the sort of the next gen of zombie films, certainly by the time Return of the Living Dead
or Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah, those came by, you know, that was 78 for Dawn, I think. Yep. 85 for Return of the Living Dead. I mean, comedy was, boom, baked into the horror pie.
Now, what about the, because Bob Blum's not here, what about the Vincent Price stuff of the 60s? The Roger Corman films based on, like, Comedy of Terrors and those. Would you qualify that, or is that just a different tone?
Yeah, I guess it's a little bit of a different tone in that, I don't think those films were genuinely trying to scare us, just because by the constraints of the time and the MPAA rating system that came along later in 68, but the old Hollywood code, you know, I don't think they really could scare. They weren't gruesome, certainly, by any extent.
Right.
And these were movies that were very gruesome. I mean, you know, we had that juxtaposition of gruesome gore with laughs. And was intentionally trying to make you feel guilty about experiencing those almost simultaneously.
Okay, so do you own this?
I do not actually own this.
Wow.
I think I watched it on Amazon Prime or something like this. We were discussing my budget for the Reeling Backward column, which I think is still holding firm at $0. I don't spend anything on it other than my normal, you know, Netflix and Amazon Prime fees. I try not to go buy stuff,
right.
Just because, yeah, it's kind of cheating. I mean, I kind of,
okay.
All right. I've been watching some stuff on Turner Classic Movies, I finally got rid of my Netflix DVD queue after all these years, just because so much of it was getting waitlisted and wasn't really available anymore, so.
By the way, you talked about, we also talked about this earlier, you talk about how this is fun trash. Would you care to bring up a garbage example recently?
Oh, well,
we
were talking about, I finally caught up with a movie I'd never seen from the 80s, Dirty Dancing.
Oh, yeah, that too.
Which I just thought was a garbage movie. And what was the other one we were discussing?
Quigley Down Under. You irritated people with your takedown of Quigley.
That was a few weeks ago. We had Quigley Down Under. I'm sorry, I'd heard about that movie. I actually got to that movie via Burt Lancaster movie, Valdez is Coming.
Okay.
Because there's a whole thing in there about talking about, you know, this legendary rifle that he uses called the Sharps, which is a single shot rifle that came out in 1848 that could, like, hit targets from 600 yards away. This is a time when, you know, the Civil War proceeded that were, you know, most firefights took place from, like, 25 feet away. And so that weapon is featured prominently also in Quigley Down Under, starring Tom Selleck. So that kind of led me to that, and I really liked Valdez is Coming, so I was hoping I was going to like Quigley Down Under, and I know a lot of people are really enthusiastic about it, and yeah, that's just a garbage movie. just, I mean, it's so bad. I mean, the premise is The premise is, I mean, granted, all movies have plot holes. All movies you can sit there and pick apart and say that doesn't make sense if you step back and think about it. But when you have like the essential basic premise of which things proceed from being like, brr, then I have a hard time swallowing movies. So the setup of Quigley Down Under is that a rancher in Australia has put an ad in newspapers promising $50 to the world's greatest sharpshooter to come there and work for him. And Quigley answers the ad by just sending the ad back with three bullseyes shot through it with a note that says, like, Quigley did this from 500 yards away or whatever. So he then proceeds to travel from America to Australia, not knowing what the job is, and then is mad because the job is to go assassinate Aborigines.
Meanwhile, the prostitutes in Unforgiven offered $1,000.
Yes, yes. First of all, I'm pretty sure he probably spent more than $50 just on the trip. Just the boat ride across the ocean to get to Australia almost certainly cost more than $50. B, who wouldn't ask, so what's the job? What are you doing? And third, if you're the world's greatest sharpshooter, there's a pretty limited range of vocations to which you can put forward your skills. It's pretty much assassination or shooting wolves. And I don't think anyone's going to recruit someone from across the world to shoot wolves.
Can't he become Professor Quigley and teach at the Sharpshooting Academy?
Maybe, in fact, he can. I don't know. And let's put this. And the guy who directed it, I can't remember his name, but he was a TV guy before and a TV guy afterwards, starring Tom Selleck. You know, as I said, these guys were titans of their genre of television.
Simon Winsor.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with being great at television. There's a lot of amazing television on today. Why not just make television?
Okay, I'm gonna add. I think in 20. By the way, Tracy Forner loves this film, and I actually got his hair mussed up about your comments. So, I think in 2018, I want to get you two in here for a Quigley Down Under throwdown.
Yes, I was also having an earlier throwdown, actually earlier today, about The Last Jedi.
Oh, jeez.
But my complaint, same thing, is that there's an entire plot sequence that takes forward from the fact that two people park their starship illegally on the beach. And first of all, the fact that they're there to bribe a guy. So obviously they've got money. They couldn't just park at the spaceport. I mean, it's supposed to be a whole like Las Vegas-y gambling planet. They don't have a spaceport. You can pay money to park it. You got to park on the beach. And B, that the entire city of this thing freaks out about the fact that someone parked their spaceship illegally, and we've got to like pull out the space SWAT team to go after the illegal parkers instead of putting the, you know, equivalent of the boot on their ship. I hate stuff like that. It's just like so dumb that, I mean, like, did you think about that for more than like a second? And of course, I had somebody on there defending. Well, no, they're just kids. Just they're newbies to the rebellion and they don't think too far ahead. It's like we were flying to this planet to bribe a guy, but we don't have money to park our spaceship. Okay.
You're right there. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to slightly defend Australian filmmaker Simon Winsor for a moment.
He also made... Go ahead.
All right, yeah. You knew where I was going to.
Yes.
He knows where...
Speaking of mastering television, there's your setup.
I'm going to rattle off my his IMDb list. Yeah. Far Lap, Daryl, his follow-up to Quigley Down Under. By the way, the other thing about Quigley Down Under, people love Alan Rickman in that because he's kind of doing...
And that was in between Die Hard and Robin Hood.
So he was setting up. So yeah. It's a good stepping stone for Sheriff of Nottingham. The less we talk about Laura Sangiacomo and her accent, the better. And I like looking at Laura Sangiacomo.
Yeah, and that was pretty much the peak of her career was right about then.
Right. His follow-up to Quigley Down Under was Harley Davidson and the Marlboro Man with Mickey Rourke and Don Johnson looking like a quasi-village people with guns. And it looks futuristic and retro at the same time. And it's that's have several cocktails and enjoy bad.
Yeah.
It's fun bad. The first Free Willy.
Yeah.
So he made Michael Madsen a sympathetic character, but that's not in Thelma and Louise.
Yeah.
Thank you there. Okay, then we get to Lightning Jack.
Yeah.
Operation Dumbo Drop, The Phantom, Crocodile Dundee in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And the Young Black Stallion. And
yeah.
then, but yeah, a lot of TV in between. So there you go. Okay. I want to go back a little bit to Bob Clark. As we were talking, Chris has a wonderful write-up on Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, his third feature.
That's right.
His follow-ups to that. Now, we talked about the footnotes. He has some fascinating footnotes and talked about eclectic work.
One last thing on Quigley Down Under, the Simon Winsor. The thing that he made right before Quigley Down Under was Lonesome Dove.
Ah, yes.
Which, so, as I said, you can be a master of television. There's nothing wrong with
and
that.
And still make what Chris thinks is garbage. So, So Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, his follow-up, he had two films in 1974, Dead of Night, and one, if you know the horror genre, the original Black Christmas.
Yeah.
So smaller Black Christmas reunion now that Margot Kidder has passed, Olivia Hussey, Andrea Martin. So introducing Christmas into the horror genre, and I believe this is the film responsible for The Call is Coming from Inside the House.
Yes.
So,
and then just
John Saxon.
And then he just had a very eclectic career. He went out to make like some high-toned films with like Jack Lemmon.
Yeah, we're getting to that. So Murder by Decree in 1979, that was a Sherlock Holmes film with Christopher Plummer also and James Mason as Dr. Watson. His follow-up to that was Tribute. So Jack Lemmon got a nomination for that, Robbie Benson. He followed up Tribute with Porky's.
Porky's, yes. The guy made the same guy that
in Porky's 2.
And then Porky's 2.
Not enough. Couldn't bring him back for Porky's Revenge, and that's really okay. But yeah, Porky's here on the show, because we've done shows devoted to the Hollywood Nights, the horny teenager movies of the late 70s and early 80s, and this was one of the high points.
Really? Really? I mean, if you look at what is now what we call the teen sex comedy, Porky's pretty much resides at the base of that. It pretty much spawned that whole genre.
I'm gonna word this carefully. I believe Porky's was the first film to incorporate a man putting something in somewhere.
Maybe.
That's, I think. Yeah. Well, Jason Biggs knows exactly what I'm talking about.
Yes.
So that sequence, it's, I mean, I was 12, and I've talked about this before, especially from American Pie after. There are still R-rated comedies out there, or as Mrs. Soucy likes to say, made by boys for boys. And I can watch it and go, I would have really enjoyed that if I was 10 years, 20 years, 30 years younger.
Yeah.
But this, because you hit them at a certain point. I was 12 when Porky's came out. Kind of the perfect time for that.
Yes. And, so, of course, then we know what he followed up the Porky's movies with.
He did that. He did Porky's 2, and then he come to a film which I think is extremely overrated and will anger people because I don't like it.
This is your Quigley Down Under.
Yes. A Christmas Story.
Yes. We're talking about Ralphie and the Red Ryder BB gun.
Right. And if you think about the tone, I mean, it's an odd feeling film. It is not, I mean,
it is not a warm and fuzzy film.
No, it has these kind of weird moments, and especially like Ralphie going up the steps to meet Santa. I'm like, oh, that's totally a Black Christmas look.
Yes, people forget. It's now looked upon as this great nostalgic film, but
right.
I mean, it was really in a lot of ways the anti-Christmas nostalgia movie when it came out.
That's right.
But yeah, people are always amazed when I tell them that the same guy who made A Christmas Story also made Porky's, Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things.
Yep.
And Black Christmas. They just can't wrap their mind. But
Bob Clark did.
Yeah, he started out pretty much in horror. He also made a film. I think one of his early ones was about a Vietnam veteran.
Breaking Point. Yep.
Yeah, who comes home and
Dead
is having.
Dead of Night is another early
one. It was sort of a zombie film. Symbolically.
Guys,
yeah.
Yeah.
And then he kind of went into the high toned.
Murder by Decree and Tribute. That's not bad.
Yeah, and then into teenage sex comedies, and then nostalgia, and then he went into he did Turk 182.
Actually, his follow up to A Christmas Story was Rhinestone.
Yeah.
So yeah, a film where you have Dolly Parton and Sylvester Stallone, and you want Sly to sing.
Yes.
I saw that in theater, and that's a turd on toast, man. Yeah. That's really bad.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the point where he was cashing in. That was his cashing in
phase.
Yeah,
and Turk 182, because I was talking earlier with Chris about Timothy Hutton. I just revisited Taps, which is a really solid film, and that was his follow-up to Ordinary People. Your first film, you win Best Supporting Actor for Ordinary People, and, you know, he's getting older. I think he was 25 and needed to do stuff, so he did Turk 182, which was kind of your... I think it came out before The Legend of Billie Jean when you had your kind of teen anti-heroes made by major studios. Yeah. From the Hip, Judd Nelson trying to be a lawyer.
Peak Judd Nelson.
Yeah. And then the buddy cop movie Loose Cannons of Gene Hackman and Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah.
Bad. So
it's like you love everybody involved in that movie, but not the movie they made.
Not this. It runs in the family, which was a sequel to Christmas Story, but not really. And then the man made not one but two
baby
geniuses film. My God,
starring my namesake.
Starring your namesake, yeah. Oh, good Lord.
But seriously, I mean, that is one of the most eclectic filmographies of anybody in Hollywood.
That's really, really. Yeah.
And people know that may know the final thing is that he was actually tragically killed in a car accident along with his son. I think they were like driving along the highway in Los Angeles, and like a beam came off of a truck or something and killed them both. This is like 2005 or something like 2007.
Yeah, his last credit was a TV movie called The Karate Dog.
Yeah.
And he also did a TV film of Ransom of Red Chief, Catch a Falling Star, Maniac McGee, The American Clock. So has there been a documentary made about him?
No.
Surprise, there has not.
If I've ever liked teaching like a community college class, it will be the filmography of Bob Clark.
That's pretty good. Yeah. I would say, hey, Netflix, get on this. Because I know there's one for John Avildsen, which I have not watched yet. But I think Clark would definitely qualify.
Yeah.
All right. We just got a little bit of time. But Chris, tell people what's happening over at the Film Yap, besides Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things.
Oh, just, you know, trying to keep ahead of all the movies coming out. You know, it's a constant battle. It's like we've got, like, usually, like, a couple of movies that are screened for us every week. And there's usually a couple other movies coming out that aren't screened. So you got to kind of try and go catch them. There's a film coming out next week. I forget the name of it. But it's starring Lakeith Stanfield, who's a young actor I'm very, very high on. They're not screening for that for us. So perspectives. Declarations, flags being planted, as you say.
As Joe would say, a little of this, a little of that. And Chris declaring films garbage that people like.
It's garbage.
And I know also next week is a, I don't know if it's a follow-up, but it's the latest film from the director of Winter's Bone.
Oh, yes, called Leave No Trace. I actually saw that movie months ago, and I've been dying to get my review up. I've been seeing some really superlatively enthusiastic reviews, early reviews of that. I'm not quite there, but with one of our favorite That Guy character actors, Ben Foster.
Oh, yes.
He is kind of the lead role in this. Plays a, without giving too much away, father and daughter living in the woods, having to sort of re-enter society.
We got about a couple minutes left, but I would say I think the first half of this year is particularly strong.
Yeah, it's been a good year. I mean, my favorite film of this year so far is still Love, Simon. Very
and that's out on video now, I think.
Out on video, very smart, funny, and yet insightful film about a young gay teen, senior in high school, looking to come out. It's not the movie where he's trying to figure out if he's gay. He already knows he's gay. He's known that for a long time. He's trying to figure out, how do I negotiate this modern jungle of school and social media and, you know, where you're not sure if the person you're talking to online is actually the person you're talking to. And he ends up getting into this very sort of Cyrano de Bergerac situation where he's, you know, in love with someone he's never actually met, or that thinks that, you know, he's fantasizing about who it actually is at his school. And just, I thought, a very wonderfully smart, sensitive, and funny film about teens. And boy, we don't get too many of those.
Is there a de-gaying camp sequence?
A what?
Those de-gaying camps.
Oh, no, nothing like that. I mean, that's one of the things I like about this movie. It starts from a place of, he's a normal kid who's gay, and he's not sure, he doesn't feel bad about that. He just doesn't know how to tell people.
Sorry, Mike. All right, Chris, thank you for hanging out with me.
My pleasure, as always.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. Ladies and gentlemen, some words to live by.
Silent Breed is people!
Zardoz.
has spoken.
We'll finish the show with Ennio Morricone's theme, main theme from The Great Silence. Go see a good movie, you deserve it. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI HD to the Point and WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What kind of parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!